I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 21st of August. Our guest this hour says of the war on drugs, if we are going to empty our prisons of tens of thousands of nonviolent offenders, if we are to ease the horrific financial burden we've created for ourselves through mass incarceration, if we're to end the war on drugs with a realistic acknowledgement that there can be an honorable withdrawal, if we are to bring prison conditions back to constitutional standards, the time is now. Last week, Attorney General Eric Holder called for changes to the criminal justice system, scaling back harsh sentences for some drug-related crimes. There are now 25,000 drug convictions in federal court each year, 45% of those for lower-level offenses. There are currently about 225,000 state prisoners incarcerated for drug offenses. Federal prisons are operating at nearly 40% above capacity and hold more than 219,000 inmates. And then, of course, we have a huge number, 9 to 10 million prisoners going through local jails each year. So we're going to be looking at what the Attorney General had to say about changes to the criminal justice system. We'll have two guests with us during the course of this hour. Andrew Cohn joining us momentarily, a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice. And later we'll speak with the executive director of the Benedict Center, which is a longtime Wisconsin community-based alternative program to incarceration. I would imagine we'll have a lot of phone calls this hour on this issue. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Andrew is a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice, also contributing editor at The Atlantic, legal analyst for 60 Minutes, and chief analyst and legal editor for CBS Radio News. Andrew, thank you so much for being with us.
It is my pleasure.
Let's start with Eric Holder's comments last week. What was he saying exactly? How important was he saying, and does it make any difference?
Well, he didn't just make a statement. What he did was change executive branch policy with respect to mandatory sentences, basically directing federal prosecutors, U.S. attorneys around the country to deprioritize low-level drug offenses, not to bring as many federal drug cases in federal courts, even in cases where there may have been a little bit of drug dealing instead of drug possession. And, of course, that's a pretty significant step from this administration, which in some ways has been very tough on crime, has continued to be tough on crime. So you're seeing a policy change within the executive branch that is designed to reduce the inflow into the justice system, the inflow into our federal prisons, which over time will reduce the number of prisoners. That's the most important thing the Attorney General announced last week.
So does there need to be some kind of legislative response as well?
I think so, because remember, when a Justice Department does X or Y, it doesn't necessarily bound the next Justice Department from doing A or B.
Right.
So you have a policy now of the Obama administration that the next administration, if it doesn't agree with, can change. So, yes, there needs to be legislative movement, and there actually is some legislative movement. There are, on Capitol Hill, pending several measures. Senator Leahy has a bipartisan measure that's designed, called the Safety Justice of Valve, Safety Valve Act. There is some bipartisan legislation pending on the House side that has support that is designed to basically confront this and say, you know what, we're spending too much on prisons on the federal side. We should be figuring out a smarter way to punish, you know, severe drug offenses, but also to allow more people to be free from prison so we don't have to pay for it. And it'll be interesting. I mentioned in the piece that I wrote last week and that I've covered for The Atlantic, you know, there is this bipartisan consensus now. Conservatives and Democrats alike are saying, this is it. We need to do something before we spend more money on this.
You have written that there's still far to go to remedy the harm that America's futile war on drugs has caused to so many. What is that harm?
Well, we see it all over. There was a documentary about it, in December. What you're doing is you're not putting drug kingpins away necessarily, although you're doing that as well. You are, by criminalizing marijuana, by criminalizing other low-level forms of drug offenses, you're, you know, disrupting communities, and you're disrupting families, and you're creating this class of citizen even when people leave prison, right? They don't have the same rights that other people have. And so you have this vast over-criminalization that the Brennan Center has written so much about that really doesn't do much good for the society. It doesn't generate tax revenues. It is a burden on tax-paying people who have to pay for these prisons on both the federal level and the state level. And so what you're seeing, finally, is this coalescence of ideologies on this. Progressives and liberals have always said, this is the war on drugs is too harsh, it is too unfocused, we need to figure out a smarter way to do it, a cheaper way to do it, so that we're not sending so many people to jail. Conservatives in the last 5 or 10 years, and here's where the big changes come, also have come to conclude that we're simply spending too much money on prisons. Mm-hmm. That there's an economic and a financial case to be smarter in the war on drugs. And once those conservatives, men, you know, people like Pat Robertson and folks on the very conservative side of the spectrum, started making these arguments, well, that's the, you know, the essence of a bipartisan approach. And I think that's almost where we are today.
And these federal prisons, I guess almost half of the people in them are serving time for drug-related crimes, are really, really overcrowded, aren't they?
Well, they're terribly over. Well, listen, many prisons are overcrowded. The Supreme Court had to stop or try to stop California's unconstitutionally overcrowded state prisons. I have written at The Atlantic at length about the Supermax facilities, the administration, the administrative detention facilities, where conditions are deplorable. And the Bureau of Prisons is largely held unaccountable for a lot of that stuff. So in addition to what the Attorney General said about reducing the number of cases and thus reducing the number of new prisoners, the feds are also figuring out a way to get rid of some of the older prisoners. And so they're going to, broaden the standards by which older prisoners can get out of prison once they are able to establish that they're no longer going to be a danger to the community. It's been a very tight standard. And so the idea is, if you're in your 70s or if you're in your 80s and you're serving a life sentence, and you're obviously not going to pose a danger to the community, and you've served X amount of time, some of those prisoners are going to be released as well. Now, what those prisoners are going to do once they're gone, are they going to be able to come back into society in some successful way? We won't know. But the idea is to begin to empty the prisons so that people are paying less in taxpayer dollars for these prison systems all over the country.
You talk about the single biggest cause of our mass incarceration being the criminalization of marijuana. How are marijuana offenses dealt with? How have they been dealt with?
Well, they've been dealt with harshly, and it's because of this classification of marijuana as a Schedule I drug on the par with heroin. And, you know, it's an issue that is turning politically as well, right? In the last election in Colorado, in the state of Washington, voters said enough. We're not going to criminalize it anymore. In fact, we're going to legalize it. Mm-hmm. We're going to consider it like alcohol or tobacco. We're going to legalize it. We're going to tax it. We're going to regulate it. And we're going to use the income from this product to build schools and to build roads and to do things like that. So far, the administration has allowed these states to progress down this road without interfering, without basically saying that states that do this are violating federal law, but there is going to be a reckoning at some point. The administration is going to have to, you know, pick a side in that. And some people believe, some people in Washington, some people in these other states believe, that the administration is more open-minded to the idea of allowing some states to decriminalize and regulate and tax marijuana as a, you know, as an experiment, if you will, to see if it really works and to see that the world doesn't end. And, of course, the argument there is medical marijuana now is legal in more than a dozen states, and the sky hasn't fallen, and, you know, people aren't necessarily more dangerous. And so there's movement on that front, too. Until and unless that changes, I think you're still going to have a ton of people in prison who many people think shouldn't be there.
Let's go back to the changes that Eric Holder called for. Are there questions, Andrew, about how the attorneys' offices around the country will implement these changes, or are they pretty specifically laid out?
I think there are always questions when you try to implement a national policy down to the local level. There is always going to be discretion for prosecutors to prosecute certain people and to not prosecute other people. The Justice Department gives guidelines to its field lawyers And I'm sure that there are going to be statistics once this new policy is in place to evaluate how well it's going. And also there's the human factor. I imagine that some federal prosecutors are more enthusiastic about the new policy than others. And the same goes for judges. I have spoken to many federal judges over the past few years who have been itching to have more discretion to avoid mandatory minimums, who have been itching for more discretion to not send away people to, you know, ruin people's lives for relatively minor offenses. That is happening or is going to be able to happen more often now in light of this new policy, and it will continue to happen if the Congress acts and actually changes these guidelines and changes some of the rules.
Let's welcome phone calls. Here's how you reach our conversation with Andrew Cohn. He is the executive director, fellow at the Brennan Center, also a contributing editor at The Atlantic, legal analyst for 60 Minutes, and chief analyst and legal editor for CBS Radio News. We're talking about mandatory minimums, changes to the criminal justice system, which Attorney General Eric Holder outlined yesterday, scaling back harsh sentences for some drug-related crimes. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, leave messages there as well. The Kathleen Dunn Show. Todd in Winona is our first caller. Hi, Todd.
Hi. I'm going to first make a statement, then I'm going to lead that to a question. I've been around since the war on drugs started, and I wish that it was not called that any longer. I think that'd be one weight out of this mess. But I also want to point out that, at least by your guest's comment, it's not about, for Republicans, it's not about families, even though the damage to families is terrible. It's not about the people who we put in prison or very few options once they come out. It's about money. And the irony of that for a party that so much more strongly than Democrats identifies themselves with Christianity.
And it's about money.
So I wanted to know, are there Republicans who are saying, you know, as Christians, as a party that identifies ourselves with that, there's more to it than just money? Or am I wrong?
And is it about money, do you think, Andrew?
I think it is in many ways about money. I think once the economic case was so clearly made, mostly by conservatives but also by progressives in favor of sentencing reform, once the economic case was made that people should be spending more money on schools than on prison, Pat Robertson, just to track what this caller has mentioned, Pat Robertson a couple of years ago, and I wrote about this at the time, said, why is California spending more money on prisons than on education? It should legalize marijuana. When you start getting that economic case from that person, that sort of crystallizes the movement. And so far, no one has come forward and said, no, the economic case against sentencing reform is as strong as is the case for sentencing reform. So that's, I think, a big part of the reason why conservatives are on board or getting on board. They don't want to spend more taxpayer money on this. They want to spend less taxpayer money anyway, and they certainly don't want to spend it on prisons.
Mm-hmm. I know that you're also concerned about private prisons. Boy, we had a flurry of prisons being built all over this country during the war on drugs. What happens to those prisons, and is that a part of the money equation, that we spend a whole lot of money to private concerns to build them?
I think private prisons are one of the worst ideas of the past few decades. I think they are notorious already. And I think the prison lobby, the private prison lobby, and to an extent the public prison lobby, is pretty powerful. And I think if there's going to be opposition to sentencing reform, if there's going to be opposition to closing prisons, it's going to come from these lobbies who are going to come to lawmakers on the state level, lawmakers on the federal level, and say, no, you know, we still need this. This is necessary as a criminal justice issue. It's necessary as a safety issue. I guess the point I'm trying to make is the war over the war on drugs is not yet won, and there are going to be some battles, and there are going to be some skirmishes on Capitol Hill. But, again, I think the momentum is clearly in one direction, and one of the ways you can tell that is that there wasn't this outcry after Attorney General Holder announced the new policy. There wasn't this conservative uproar. there was this grudging acknowledgement that it wasn't such a bad idea.
Thanks, Todd, for the call. Arnie in Green Bay. Hi.
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 How you doing?
I'm fine. Go ahead, Arnie.
Well, I just got arrested last Wednesday with 12 marijuana plants growing in my basement. I've worked all my life. Good jobs. Saved a little bit every year. I got $350,000 in the bank, and they froze it, and they're going to take it. They're going to take my $85,000 house, my two cars that are worth about $20,000 for 12 marijuana plants. And I just think I'm on the front lines right now.
How did this happen? How did this happen? Do you know?
Yeah, they smelled it, and they asked me. I showed them where everything was. They told me I was the politest guy they ever arrested. But I got two felonies against me, two misdemeanors. They froze all my money. I can't even hire an attorney, and I feel like they're ruining my life.
Andrew.
Yeah, there's a couple of issues there. I mean, some states now are decriminalizing marijuana possession. In fact, a couple of states are going in that direction. There doesn't seem to be an uproar. The other issue, though, that you know, we're talking about here also is forfeiture. When they seize your assets and you're not able to use those assets in your own defense, there was a wonderful piece 2 weeks ago in The New Yorker by a great reporter named Sarah Stillman. I think it's called Taken. If you want to find it online, it might be helpful for you to understand. These are civil forfeiture cases where basically you don't get accused of a crime, but you lose the assets, you know, the property that may have been used in it. That's not necessarily your situation, but it's close. And, you know, it is a state matter what is happening with respect to those kinds of marijuana arrests. Some states have been more proactive in coming up with smarter solutions. Some states haven't been, and I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. I think everyone in this part of the criminal justice area, marijuana possession, marijuana laws, are looking to see how the feds react to Colorado and Washington, looking to see whether there's chaos in those two states once everything is regulated and taxed, or whether things just go on the way they were before.
It's interesting, though, that this would happen to Arnie at a time right after the Attorney General made this statement on these kinds of drugs.
But the Attorney General is talking about federal officials, right? And I don't think Arnie is talking about federal officials. I'd be surprised if the feds have seized Arnie's plants. I think that's more of a Wisconsin issue, and then that comes down to county enforcement, it comes down to state enforcement, it comes down to state laws. I'm not as up to date on Wisconsin's marijuana laws as I probably should be before I answered the phone, but you know, this is an area of a lot of change in many states.
Right. You would just think that, considering the fact that it was so much in the news, that it would give everybody pause on all levels to figure out what they're going to do. But evidently, that didn't happen.
Yeah, and again, you know, nothing happens with unanimity in the United States, right?
Right.
Some prosecutors are going to ignore the Attorney General's guidance. They're going to say, listen, the feds can do what they want to do. We're going to continue to do what we want to do. Some judges are going to have that reaction, especially on the state level. Change gets implemented, you know, one piece at a time, and all that the Attorney General can focus on or direct is the federal response. I guess the way to say it is, if this were a federal matter today as opposed to 2 weeks ago, the feds would be less inclined to make that arrest and to make that indictment than they would be 2 weeks ago.
Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi.
My question is about the Attorney General himself. I'd like to know, I couldn't have been more shocked when he got up and made this this declaration the other day, because this is the very same Attorney General who only a couple of years ago turned his Justice Department loose full force on medical marijuana in California.
Yep.
And so, you know, what's the real policy here? I mean, is this somebody in the White House saying to the Attorney General, you know, the president doesn't think this is a good idea, what you're doing, or is this actually Eric Holder's opinions? I just don't understand the man.
Yeah, it's an excellent point that you've just raised. This is the same Justice Department that hit California medical marijuana very hard. It's the same Justice Department that folks in Colorado and Washington State were concerned would come down hard again. But again, there's been a big change in the nation's perceptions about this stuff, even in the past 3 or 4 years. I mean, the same way the nation has changed in some respects on same-sex marriage, it's changed on marijuana policies as more and more states have approved medical marijuana. You can see this, I guess, as a shift in the Attorney General's position and thus the Obama administration's position. But it seems to me that until the feds make a decision on Colorado and make a decision on Washington, we don't exactly know for sure. In other words, the feds can still say, in spite of this sentencing reform, hey, we still consider marijuana possession and use a crime, and we still want it enforced. That could happen after the Colorado and Washington things flesh out, and it wouldn't be the biggest surprise in the world.
Mm-hmm. Am I misremembering, or it seemed to me that right after the election, it was one of those interviews that that the president was doing with, the Barbara Walters type interviews, where I think he was asked about Washington and Colorado, and I seem to remember him saying something along the lines of, "Well, we've got bigger fish to fry than what's going on with individual small time marijuana," which, it, to my mind, I wondered if at that point he wasn't also sending a signal to his own AG, you know, you better get on board with this.
Yeah, I think that they probably talk more than that. I don't know that the president has to signal Holder on television. I have a feeling that they're pretty coordinated as client and lawyer. But yeah, you may be right. And again, we just don't know. But I think that's going to be a really significant addition to this puzzle, another piece to this puzzle, once the administration tells us what it thinks. And in large part, that's going to depend on how these states manage the regulatory scheme, how the taxing goes, how people use marijuana, how they pay for it, how it's regulated. The more official it can be, the more normal it can be, the more like alcohol and tobacco it can be, the less inclined the administration will be to do something about it. And that's why it's fascinating to see this unfold in these two laboratory states, if you will. A lot of people in a lot of other states are watching it.
Yeah, I'm sure. Thanks, Scott, so much, as always, for your call. And it bears, as we almost say goodbye to you, we know this, but it's worth repeating the racial disparity when it comes to drug offenses. African Americans, 30% of federal drug convictions every year. Hispanics, about 40%. Those are huge percentages.
Absolutely. There's terrible racial disparity in the criminal justice system, not just in sentencing. To the extent that the administration is going to sort of tweak the rules, you hope that that disparity is going to go away, and that it's going to go away from the one end of the system, from arrests to indictments to convictions to sentences all the way through the system. That would be a wonderful thing to happen, and that is also, or should be, a bipartisan movement. So we'll have to wait and see on that. Certainly it's good news, but in that respect especially, there's an awful lot for this administration to do. There's an awful lot for the courts to do, and there's an awful lot for Congress to do as well.
Isn't it interesting, Andrew, that sometimes we just make the wrong decisions and it takes us a long time to change them, and a whole lot of money and a lot of people in prison later we change the policy?
Yeah. I mean, this has been a 40-year-old catastrophe, expensive catastrophe. It has in some ways been, made things safer on some levels, but it's also had a tremendous cost. And the other thing to keep in mind, too, is that it comes from a classification of marijuana as an illegal substance of, 70 years ago. That's a decision that still the federal government hasn't come to grips with. One other thing the administration can do, if it's serious about reform, is to have the DEA do a new study, to evaluate whether or not marijuana should be classified the way it is with heroin and these other serious drugs. A lot of people believe that it has this medicinal property that should be recognized, and that would be a big deal as well.
Yeah. Andrew, thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Anytime.
All right. Andrew Cohn, fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice, also contributing editor at The Atlantic, legal analyst for 60 Minutes, chief analyst and legal editor for CBS Radio News. We continue our discussion. We're talking about, the conversation prompted by Attorney General Eric Holder's comments last week calling for changes to the criminal justice system, and we are looking at harsh sentences for some drug-related crimes and how we have so many people in prisons, making prisons terribly overcrowded, spent a whole lot of money on that, and so we're resulting now in altering a Justice Department policy, although as We carefully heard the last half hour of the program. States are dealing with this on a whole different level. Is it time for us to look very seriously on a state level, on all levels, at drug-related crimes and look at the prison sentences for those crimes and think that maybe there should be a better way? We are going to continue the conversation with the executive director of the Benedict Center, the last part of this program, a Wisconsin community-based alternative program to incarceration. Our phone number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We now invite to our program a new guest, Jean Gerasi, who's executive director of the Benedict Center. It's a nonprofit interfaith agency that works with victims, offenders, and the community to achieve a system of criminal justice that is fair and treats every person involved with dignity and respect. They're doing some very interesting work in the Milwaukee area, and we're going to be speaking with Jean about it and welcoming more of your phone calls. We're looking at alternatives to incarceration this hour of the program. Our phone number remaining 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Jean, hello. Thank you so much for being with us. Oh, I have you on the wrong. Yeah, very good to have you on the show. Why don't you give us just a little background here on the center? You've been around for a long time, haven't you?
We have. We turn 40 next year.
Wow. And it was started, what did you see functioning in the criminal justice system that you thought might be wrong and you wanted something different?
I think that our early founders, what they saw was, in particular, women really languishing in jail, and that jail was not a place where women were necessarily getting better. There were very few services or consideration for the different needs of women in the criminal justice system, and the idea was to reach out to them and provide them an educational support and alternative to incarceration.
And what do you do now?
Very much along the same lines, for providing alternative programming and support to women in lieu of incarceration, although in 40 years a lot has developed in terms of our knowledge of drug addiction and mental health issues and trauma-informed care. And so our system is more sophisticated now, but still very much a treatment alternative program.
And when you look at the number of women that you are dealing with who have found themselves in prison because of drug-related offenses, is that a substantial number?
It really is. It's the majority of cases. The majority of women incarcerated are incarcerated for nonviolent crimes, and often they're either directly a drug charge or related to a drug addiction, for instance, shoplifting to support a drug addiction.
Mm-hmm. So were you encouraged, and do you think that it will have any effect here in the greater Milwaukee area or in Wisconsin with the Attorney General's comments about drug-related offenses?
We were really greatly encouraged because it's giving federal recognition to a problem that we know has been happening for a long time. And we think it's a great start, and I think we agree with your earlier guest, Andrew Cohen, that more needs to be done. This kind of policy needs to be codified on the federal level. And then states also need to take steps to do similar reform, because there's many more people also incarcerated in state prisons for nonviolent drug-related causes. Some states have actually begun justice reinvestment initiatives where they are actually modifying their sentencing. Wisconsin still needs to do that.
We just heard from somebody who was growing marijuana plants in his basement and was arrested and is in pretty serious trouble as a result of that, which made me wonder where Wisconsin stood on all of this. Do you think that what has happened with federal recommendations will somehow trickle down to the state? Will it force states to deal with this issue?
I don't know if it'll force states to deal with the issue, but I think it certainly helps keep that conversation front and center. And as Andrew Cohen also mentioned, what's very encouraging is growing bipartisan support for this kind of reform, and recognizing that in addition to the human cost of mass incarceration, there's a tremendous fiscal cost as well. In 2011, we spent $1.3 billion in Wisconsin's budget on Department of you know, for prisons, basically. And that money really needs to be reallocated to drug treatment instead of drug enforcement, and then also education and employment initiatives.
And how much money is available for what you just outlined there? Because if you're in prison for one of these offenses, and it, particularly if you got there because you have an addiction that you're trying to find the money to feed, what happens when you get out?
Well, it varies, and I think that the Department of Corrections right now is very much trying to focus on ensuring that people have more successful reentry efforts, but the resources for community-based treatment is tight, and frankly, the way to really make that work is to reallocate the funds from the prisons into those community-based treatment programs. And what the Benedict Center offers is a great model. The first choice is to divert people into treatment programs before ever even going into jail. That minimizes a lot of costs, particularly for women and the separation of women from their children, but then also looking at the reentry side as well and ensuring that people are connected with the resources they need for successful reentry.
Mm-hmm. Let's welcome phone calls for you. Our number, 800-486-8655. Todd in Woodruff. Hi, Todd.
Hello.
Go ahead, Todd.
What I would like to say is the war on drugs seems kind of ridiculous to me, but in looking for a solution, we know that it's less expensive by quite a bit to send someone to college than it is to incarcerate them. So I'm wondering why we don't consider taking first-time offenders and offer them the opportunity to go to college, become educated, and become a tax-paying individual rather than going to prison, which we know creates lifetime criminals.
Jean.
Well, I would agree about reallocating funds, and certainly would agree that on a macro level, funds need to be shifted to education. Some of that needs to start earlier on in a person's life, but there is a great return for treatment alternatives rather than incarceration monetarily for the system, as well as just having better outcomes for the person actually improving their life. A great story we have, there's a woman named Julie who graduated from our program. She was caught for shoplifting to support a drug habit, was sentenced to 7 months in the House of Corrections, received no treatment, and came out with absolutely no change to her underlying behavior. So as soon as she got out, she stole again and got caught again, except the next time around she actually was diverted into our program instead, where for the first time she received the kind of counseling she needed to really address some of those underlying behaviors. And today she's drug-free, she's crime-free, and she's contributing to the community again. That's the kind of difference we can make. No one magically changes just by being incarcerated. They really need interventions that are evidence-based and meaningful.
And what about treatment programs? Have they become more effective as the years go on?
Absolutely. More and more, the bar is being raised for treatment providers like the Benedict Center to follow evidence-based curriculum, which means that it's been researched and proven to work. We're using science to make sure that we give a better service.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about Julie graduating from the program, tell me more about the program. How long is it? What's all involved in it?
Sure. Well, the Women's Harm Reduction Program is really a wraparound set of programs that involves and includes a number of trauma-informed services, including drug and alcohol counseling, but also helping people resolve their trauma, which is a huge underlying issue for people in the system. We also have adult education, parenting classes, anger and stress management. The list goes on. And so each person gets an individualized case plan. And then how long they're in the program will depend on how long that the justice system may order them to be in the program and how long their treatment needs actually exist. So it could be 6 months to a year for the basic treatment program, and then if they're involved with our adult education program, they could stay with us longer.
Todd, thanks for your call. Pat in Wauwatosa, hi.
Hello. I have several issues. I hope you don't cut me off as talking too much. I visit a young woman who, well, she's been at Tashita. Right now she's at a special treatment program at Winnebago, but it's ironic as I go up to Tashita, I have to compliment the staff. I think many of her needs were met, but she is there sentenced for a violent crime committed during an alcoholic blackout. And it troubles me, since she never was in trouble with the law before, that our governor seems to have cut out, like, time off, clearly defined time off for good behavior or a sentence reduction. there's some kind of a program, but it's a little bit murky. And the irony is, I said to her, what's that new building going up here in Tashita? Oh, that's for the mentally ill. The irony is that we have all these mentally ill people in our prisons. They had funds to build something where we don't have adequate programs in our community. And the other thing I've often, then she, my friend was at a correctional, what they call a correctional center. I think there's only two for women in the state and maybe 14 for men. And I could see, Tashita was the showcase. She said to me, the plumbing is not working. Things aren't really quite as nice. I think if they take people through, they see Tashita, where, as I say, I compliment the warden and the staff. There are programs, but we sure should have a program maybe on some of our correctional centers in the state, Kathleen. And the other thing is, I understand in Minnesota, they have half as many people in their prisons as we do because they told counties, you pay per person that you have to send to our prisons as compared with keeping them in your community with community programs. So that would be something I think we should be talking about in terms of reducing our prison sentences. I see how good the counseling is, but I also think we would be better. A lot of the young women, I've only visited the women's prison, so I know I want anybody I'm scared stiff of in prison, but and I see a minute I can recognize perhaps probably bipolar disorder or things like that lead people to behavior that causes a sentence. It would be so much better. And if conservatives, I saw an article some years ago, I couldn't put my hand on it right away, Newt Gingrich and somebody else had an editorial about it would be so much cheaper if we reduced our prison population, had community programs. Somebody called and said, is this all about money in the previous half hour of the show? And I thought, well, if we have to tap people that way to finally get through to them, if they don't, we can't appeal to their humanity, let's hope we can talk to them about money.
Thank you, Pat, so much. A lot there. Take what you want, Jean.
Well, I really enjoyed the caller's comments, and there is, in fact, an effort in the state of Wisconsin. It's called the 11 by 15 campaign that's being led by an organization called Wisdom, and the Benedict Center is a part of that campaign. And the goal there is to reduce the state prison population in half by the year 2015. And by cutting it in half, we would actually bring it more on par with our sister state, Minnesota, which has a similar state population, a similar crime rate, and yet half of the number of people incarcerated. Wisconsin is making top national charts that we don't want to be making. Most recently, a study came out that showed that we had the highest incarceration rate of African-American men in the United States.
Goodness.
And some of the underlying causes go to mandatory minimum sentencing laws and truth in sentencing laws and the three-strike rules, which completely take the judge's discretion to consider mitigating circumstances away, much like the woman who perhaps had mental illness or an alcoholic blackout but otherwise was not a violent a violent offender and perhaps really doesn't belong in prison in the first place. But there are ways to get involved through the 11 by 15 campaign to become more educated about the issues happening and to try and help have that dialogue in our state so that we could move towards some of the policies that many other states, even states that are considered more conservative than Wisconsin or Minnesota, are undertaking. Because and one of the big motivators is saving money in the long run. And that's becoming more clear.
So how do you deal at the Benedict Center, and how does the criminal justice system deal with what I'm sure are substantial, because they're substantial in the population that's outside of prison, but within the prison, how are those issues dealt with?
Within
your organization, okay, and also within prisons in the state of Wisconsin, if they are.
I think one thing that's exciting about the Benedict Center is its ability to have creatively and innovatively partnered with pieces of the criminal justice system, whether it's the court system or Department of Corrections or even the local Milwaukee Police Department, to experiment with diversions and deferred prosecution agreements and treatment alternatives. So we're very much working with the system and modeling the fact that they can send women to our program instead of incarcerating them, and we can actually help them do better. And we're hoping to take that evidence and use it for the argument to expand that kind of practice.
More phone calls in a moment. Pat, thank you so much for your valuable call. Our phone number, we're talking about, well, a variety of issues, because you can't talk about prison population without taking in a whole lot of other issues. Our conversation started at the beginning of the hour because we were looking at Eric Holder's announcement that the Justice Department would no longer pursue mandatory minimum sentences for certain low-level nonviolent drug offenders. That has us looking, of course, at the huge number of Americans who are in prison because of those very offenses, and how the country will respond to this. This half hour, we are speaking with the director of the Benedict Center, which is an organization been around since 1974, and they are a community-based alternative program to incarceration. And our guest is Jean Gerasi, who is the executive director of that organization. Phone calls for you to join us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. What is the best way to deal with nonviolent drug offenders in our society? What do you think about Holder's comments? What do you think about what you're hearing from Jean as to an alternative to an incarceration? Is this the way we should go? And can we do it less expensively, because some things can come down to money? More phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Email came in for you, Jean, wanting to know if it's true that nonviolent offenders who are incarcerated usually develop into violent offenders.
I'm not sure that it's true that happens, but what is documented is that the impact of being incarcerated can create trauma. And, in fact, there's also documented, abuses that sometimes happen, particularly to women. And so the damage done by incarceration and the cost of incarceration isn't really just limited to the dollars it costs to incarcerate a specific woman, say, for a year or however many years. There's also the ongoing damage done to her children because she's not been able to raise them. 10% of those children end up in the foster care system, and there's a strain on those secondary families that are supporting the children. And those children, and that is proven, are more likely to become incarcerated in the future.
Mm-hmm.
The other cost is the fact that once you have a record, you're essentially a permanent second-class citizen in this country, and you'll face discrimination for housing and employment, which is going to make it that much harder to be able to live a safe and crime-free life, and in some ways kind of creates an undertow of pressure to return to an underground form of economy.
Mm-hmm.
So it creates a really vicious cycle. And so that true cost of incarceration is harder to calculate, but it's far greater than what we're budgeting each year for the prison system.
Jim in Lake Geneva, hi.
Hello?
Yes, Jim, go ahead.
Yes, thanks, Kathleen and Jean. I think there's a little sidebar to the issue also of private prisons. And the private prison system is almost guaranteed to have 35,000 occupants every single day at the cost of anywhere from $150 to $250. And that is, and most of the people that I've been down to Stewart Detention Center in Georgia, and there were 1,700 inmates there, and they're outside the realm of the supervision of the state prison. Mm-hmm. And they're living in unholy situations there, and in the middle of nowhere, like a Dachau. And how do we address that? I mean, we can't just say, well, it's state prisons; it's all prisons. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Jim.
I would absolutely agree that private prisons can be a a very serious threat. And luckily, at this point, the state of Wisconsin doesn't have a private prison per se, although I think it's something that we need to stay aware of. And it's not to say that there isn't any kind of private companies benefiting from, you know, that section of our economy that's supported by prisons in terms of the vendors and whatnot. But I think Wisconsin needs to be careful to keep private prisons out, and then we need to contribute to that national effort to hold private prisons accountable, if not completely eliminating them.
Kathy in Saukville, hi.
Hi. I want to go back just for a minute to the comment about reducing the state population or the prison population in the state by the year 2015. And I understand that that would benefit, you know, the organization that we're talking about here. But my concern is the direction that would take, similar to the No Child Left Behind, where we're just pushing kids through the educational system and graduating children that just shouldn't be graduated just to keep our test scores up and our, you know, financial aid coming in and all those things that are happening because of that law. And I'm not that it's a bad law. I'm just saying, are we looking at other ways other than just this single organization to help these individuals, women and men? And can we really accomplish that in 2 short years?
Well, I agree that 2015 is probably a fairly lofty goal, although I think that And I won't speak so much to the original architecture of that campaign, but I think that the issue is urgent, and I think that part of the reason for selecting 2015 was to press on the urgency of that. And that's a grassroots movement that's led by a faith-based organization, but it's starting to attract attention, and it's going hand-in-hand with a lot of research that's showing that this really can be done, and other states are, in fact, doing it, and they're starting to see the results not only in lowering their incarceration rates, but also reducing their recidivism rates and reducing their overall costs. And because evidence-based practices is such a strong principle at the forefront of these, I don't think we're going to run the risk of simply pushing people out of the prisons without regard to quality of what's happening to them or what's happening to public safety, for that matter. The big push is to really make sure that everything is being measured and evaluated, and that even service providers like the Benedict Center have to be evaluated as providing best services, and we have to have outcomes that are measurable and can stand up to the test of outside scrutiny.
Thank you, Kathy, for the call. I'm sure you heard Andrew's comments about marijuana the first half hour of our program. Would you agree that the single biggest cause of our mass incarceration is the criminalization of marijuana? And what direct experience have you had with women who have been imprisoned because of possession or selling marijuana?
I would agree that criminalizing drugs in general, rather than using a treatment approach, is filling up our prisons. And I think that I think that they're right to start with marijuana, which, you know, compared to harder drugs like heroin, seems to have less of a harmful impact on people. We do certainly see women who are charged with marijuana charges here, and you know, part of the conversation is that at this current stage in our society and our laws, this is illegal and there are consequences to these actions. But we take a harm reduction approach, which is to start with where the person is at and make gradual changes. And it's really about them identifying the kind of life that they would like to have and whether they can start to see where drug use, regardless of what they're using, is impeding their ability to reach those goals, whether it's the direct side effect of the drug or whether it's the legal consequences of the legality of the drug.
About 45 seconds left. Tim in Green Bay. Hi. Tim, are you there? I'm sorry, we somehow have lost Tim. Well, any final remarks you want to leave us with, things that need to be done immediately, Jean, and before we have to say goodbye?
Thank you. Sentencing reform and alternatives to incarceration is really what's going to make the most sense for our criminal justice system, and it will create a healthier and safer community.
And you think we're moving in that direction?
I do. I think we've got a long ways to go, but I think that that critical mass of support is building.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Jean Girasi, our guest this part of the show. She works with a very interesting program based here in Milwaukee. She's executive director of the Benedict Center, a Wisconsin community-based alternative program to incarceration. They've worked with victims, offenders, and the community since 1974, celebrating their 40th anniversary next year. We also thank Andrew Cohn, who was in well-spoken guest, fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice and contributing editor at The Atlantic, legal analyst for 60 Minutes. Thanks to K.P. Whaley and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this program, and thanks for all of your calls and contributions to this hour. We'll be with you the next hour of the program as we talk about really good working conditions, worker cooperatives. So stay with us.